Okay, so today I'll be reading from Ajahn Suchitto's book, Kamma and the End of Kamma. I guess this is chapter one, where there's a will, there's a way. And this is, I'm starting in the middle, and I haven't read this in many, many years, so we'll see where it goes. Starting in the section called Developing Yourself to Freedom from Self. The strong inclination to sustain a self called becoming or being, bhava, stores that sense of I and me as a notion, a self-impression that lasts as the reference point for whatever my mind has been involved with. This self is thus not any entity, but a pattern, a self-construction program, ahankara, made up of emotional and psychological behaviors. These give rise to that sense that, quote, this is how I operate. These are my opinions, this is my history. And accordingly, there is the impression of being a self in such a state, with strategies on how to continue to be in it, augment it, or get out of it. But all of this is not an identity, not a fixed thing, but a process of being this and becoming that. Becoming is the core program behind Kamma. Maybe I'll just interject here that program is his working translation for sankhara in this book. It's the reason why there is so much activity in the mind, but because it's an activity, it can stop. However, becoming is deep-rooted and instinctive. It doesn't stop through reasoning. As an instinct, it has to be arrested in the depth of the heart, and that is a process which involves steering the push of intention towards clearing the selfing view. First, we need to develop strength, skill, capacity. So, much of the Buddha's teaching favors becoming in terms of becoming clearer, steadier, more warm-hearted. We generate good kamma through acts of generosity, kindness, and through letting go of behavior that does harm. We become calmer, brighter people. Right view encourages awareness of the results of what we do, awareness of sharing this world with others, and awareness of the importance of our inner psychological realm over that of sense contact. If the deeper sense of fulfillment through compassion and calm gets established, then we can let go of getting and gaining and holding on, major causes of stress. We can shift out of the drive towards self, short-term efficiency, convenience, success, comfort, and sex appeal. Then we're on the right track for liberation. Consider the social scenario. In the West, many of us can live in physical comfort, yet because we are continually being presented with more refined commodities or changing standards by which to measure ourselves, there's not much contentment. And there are social and group pressures. A person might very well feel that if they're not wearing the right clothes at their job, is at risk, so they have to bear this in mind. People can become depressed, even neurotic, if their bodies don't match up to the current standards of beauty, or if their personality is not smart enough, cynical enough, seedy enough, whatever the fashion is. We want to avoid losing out on good opportunities, and we fear the loneliness of not having any friends. So there can be a nervous feeling of inadequacy and insecurity which deprives us of a sense of trust in our innate worth as a human being. So, because of just this, it's important that we sense and define ourselves as being apart from those currents, if only to get onto some firmer ground. And what really helps is to be able to calm and collect the mind and to develop oneself in what gives greater benefit, to live one's own life with authenticity. We can cultivate simplicity of needs and a sense of truthfulness and integrity. We can gain contentment through acknowledging the good in ourselves and others. People have problems and flaws, but to recognize and honor the goodness that we all have is skillful. It's also wise to regard our tendencies towards reactivity and confusion with compassion. This is because how you attend creates the dwelling place of the mind. So we can begin to experience clarity, empathy for ourselves and others. We find ourselves living in a more appreciative and balanced way that encourages goodness to develop. In this way, we incline towards good kamma, and a basis develops that really supports our well-being. Working with the mind's impressions in this way can bring about radical changes in life. We discover that the feel-good factor required by our sense of self is most fully acquired through inclining towards ethically based, compassionate behavior. The qualities that arise from these inclinations are immensely nourishing. This is cultivating self in a right way, and it is an essential aspect of Dhamma practice. From this, we realize that we can make meaningful choices in our lives. This enables us to sense the potential in being human and encourages us to investigate it further. Insight and not self. All this good karma is based on mind cultivation, and the skill of calming and stilling the mind through meditation is another form of good or bright mental karma. Broadly speaking, there are two main meditation themes for stabilizing the mind, that of firming up attention and that of bringing well-being into the heart. These focus on good, gladdening effects to both bring immediate well-being to the mind and to switch off the really destructive programs of resentment, depression, anxiety, and the rest. So we become a good self with a mind that is calm and open. That makes it possible to investigate how self happens and how becoming can be relinquished altogether. This is the cultivation of insight. These two aspects of mental cultivation, developing a good self and becoming liberated from the self-notion, go together. When we can develop a good self, we can investigate the basis of that and realize that it is based upon states which are dependent on good programs, such as kindness, resolve, or concentration. They're not inherently yours or anyone's. This is the view of insight. Causes and conditions give rise to fortunate and unfortunate effects. Moreover, the fortunate ones arise more readily and constantly if the mind isn't preoccupied with affirming or denying a self who has or doesn't have them. That view of self as success or failure adds a bias that the mind gets stuck in, and when it's stuck, it feels stressful, and so lays down the conditions for restlessness, uncertainty, craving, despondency, and so on. But self-view has to be handled, to be penetrated and revealed as a series of stress-producing programs. Trying to get rid of this of a self involves intention, and even an attitude of indifference generates effects. Any nihilistic approach carries the seeds of dark karma. Wanting to not be anything, vibhava, still operates from the premise that one is something in the first place, and it entails the intention to annihilate. All that makes us less confident and warm-hearted in our actions and relationships. Instead, the process of awakening has to shift the emphasis from that of self-construction to one of supporting and appreciating balance in the mind. We need to feel that inner stability in the present to be able to let go of the assumptions and biases of the past and the becoming drive that strives for or is anxious about the future. And it is through that letting go of becoming that a still point where old karma ceases to affect the mind, is found. Daily practice. As everyone who practices it soon realizes, this introspective cultivation has to move against the current of much of mainstream culture. We have a massive distraction industry that encourages us to take time to get away from where we're at, read something, eat something, half watch the TV. And this takes us away from reviewing or cultivating the mind. It also often puts us into situations which we can have no responsible input. Distraction seems to offer an easy way out of stress, but it doesn't do us a lot of good. It's a way of ignoring negative effects that we don't want to or know how to deal with, but it doesn't fully remove them. For example, say your working day is stressful, and then you drive through the jangle and aggressive behavior of the traffic. All that random, rapid, and potentially risky contact agitates the nervous system. So you arrive home feeling frayed and stressed. but there's the reflex to contact something pleasant or easeful. Maybe you just flop down and eat something, drink something, or watch something on TV. You get vaguely relaxed or amused for a while, but the state of ease is superficial, induced and dependent on props. In this scenario, the mind becomes weak and undeveloped, and gradually, the forms of distraction need to become more powerful. If the pattern is allowed to persist, a lifetime can be spent becoming psychologically and emotionally weak. Most of us need reminders not to pick up the mood of the social context willy-nilly, and that we can come out of the program of the daily round. For a start, I always have a Buddha image in my living space, on a small shrine or somewhere where I can relate to it. It's something that reminds me of the value of being fully present. It encourages me to pause and acknowledge and respond to whatever state I'm in. It reminds me that the first priority is to clear some space in the mind rather than even make cultivation another thing to be busy doing. If the day rotates around fixing things, getting things done, and being on the go, it's good to learn how to moderate volition by not fixing and not getting things done or sorted out. When you are in an emotionally rocky state, the most skillful response may simply be to receive what you are feeling at the present moment with some clarity and sympathy, to sit quietly and allow things to blow through. Whatever the state, the initial response has to be to stay present and cultivate spaciousness. But the way that cause and effect work is that even 5 minutes of not acting on or suppressing the present mind state results in some kind of ease or diminution of pressure. Then we begin to recognize a natural sanity, a seed of awakening that's there when the doing stops. It's not far off, but we need to get in touch with it, get in touch and encourage it. It's always possible. The most significant realization that comes from a 5 or 10 minute break from aspects of being and becoming is that things stop by themselves. This isn't to say that a few minutes of just chilling out is the end of karma and the drawing and the dawning of ultimate truth, but it does show us that the mind can have a different direction from zigzagging forwards or backwards. The mind can open, and in that opening, the whole scenario changes. Mental awareness is experienced as a field within which thoughts, moods, and sensations come and go. And we can witness, rather than act upon, that mental content. Furthermore, a good amount of mental content just whirs to a halt when there isn't the view that one has to do, or to fix, or even stop, and there isn't the buzzy, urgent self keeping it going. This, in a nutshell, is a description of how the karma of cultivation leads to the end of karma. But it's a subtle process to undertake. Thoughts and moods don't stop through trying to make them go away. That trying is more volition, more karma. They stop when the identification program, the basis of becoming, is not switched on. This is worth remembering when one considers the complexity of the feedback loops of cause and effect. It's easy to imagine that a very complex process of unwinding would be needed. But a glimpse at how ceasing happens, through not supporting the view and energy of identification, shows us that the way out of dis-ease and stress is direct and simple, and that encourages us to set up occasions wherein we can take non-identification into deeper levels of our psychological activity. This is through the ongoing process of meditation, but we all need to, and can, back that up in our daily life. We don't have to drink the water we're swimming through. To not drink the ocean of samsara means checking and restraining the pull of the senses, checking and putting aside the programs of the mainstream, and cultivating full attention and awareness. In other words, it's a whole life path, the Eightfold Path, and that proceeds from right view and right aim, not from views of self, fate, or through automatic systems and techniques. Through following it, you realize that you're not as embedded in samsara as it might seem. For a start, you never actually become anything for very long. Sure, you seem to go through periods of agitation and tension, but with practice there are periods of joy and humor. And as you get more skilled in attending to the mind, the habit of holding on to particular states loosens up. You find yourself identifying with this or that state less and less, and that reduces the stress and turmoil. Seen like this, human life is a great opportunity. Regardless of the effects that we inherit, we can always act skillfully and cultivate the mind. We can always move towards goodness, happiness, and liberation. Maybe I'll skip forward to this other section in the next chapter. This chapter is entitled Bright Kamma, and this section is called Felt Meanings. When we look at what causes our impulses and actions, it's clear that they arise from feelings and inclinations in the heart. These mental feelings and inclinations are bound up with perceptions or felt meanings, such as feeling lonely or feeling welcome, based upon that we feel like taking a walk or feel like visiting so-and-so. There is an inclination. Somebody says something to us and we might say, "Oh, that sounded really hostile to me." That's a felt meaning, a mental perception. There's an emotive interpretation of the words that somebody uttered, and it's likely that will be the basis for intention, our inclinations, actions, and reactions. The feel in that, the perception, is a heart impression. Although it is based upon external contact, this designation contact, rather than contact with something external, is the significant formulator of the impressions that move us. Some intention is based on the body's reflexes, but mostly it's the heart impression of whatever is seen, heard, smelled, touched, tasted, or thought that gets us going, for good or bad. The felt meaning gets more powerful if we feel that someone did something to us on purpose, rather than if it was done by accident or out of coincidence. Imagine the case where a person's been rude to you 14 times this year. If they'd done it once, you'd have thought it was just a mistake. But 14 times? The present action was felt more intensely because of the previous action that had occurred. The felt meaning develops some weight dependent on an emotive inference. We can infer deliberation, "He did that on purpose," or fatalism, "I always have to put up with careless people." We can react psychologically, verbally, or physically in accordance. This is how prior impressions, attitudes, and life statements mold the heart impression. In this way, the impressions and attitudes we carry from the past become a base for intention, a base for further kamma. Also, the more we focus on and attend to our impressions, or view the world and others through old impressions, the more potent and firmly established those impressions get. But you can't rely upon heart impressions. This is because we tend to notice what we've become accustomed to notice: her gracious demeanor, his irritating mannerisms, etc. And we revisit the world in that way. We add more interpretations. Then I feel that he's always this way, or I see you in a certain way, or I notice my bad habits, or I only notice my bad habits. Thus, my focus, my attention, gets set to look out for old impressions. And I bring those to mind, mull them over, get affected by them, and act in accordance. So the scanning mind can keep selecting impressions in accordance with biases of the heart and thereby build up and intensify those biases. Attention is therefore also bound up with intention and is generating kamma. What all this means is that you can't just rely on heart alone or on attention alone. You have to cultivate skillful attention, attention to the heart, to get to the end of biases. Considering all this, how can we scan and respond more skillfully? How do we acknowledge feeling dumped on or abused and not just react or suppress? Maybe we need to say a few things to a few people, or maybe it's a matter of correcting our own misperceptions. In any case, the best way to start is by scanning the heart. This process begins with fathoming attention, yoniso manasikara, which is attention backed up by the intention to consider experience in terms of how it affects you. It is a heartful approach, whereby rather than just going along with the topic of a thought, you listen to it deeply. You sift through the flood of interpretations or digressions around topics with an inquiring sense that asks, what is the meaning behind this thought or attitude? What is the assumption, and how realistic is it? How am I with my mind being like that? This is a sympathetic, not critical, survey, and it asks you to get an accurate feel for the psychologies that direct your life. Then, is this stressful or not? This process reveals underlying impulses and heart impressions, whether these are feelings of being threatened or alienated, or of uplift and confidence. This underlying stuff is what powers how we think and what we think about. It's important to know what's making you tick in any situation. So putting a check on this process isn't a suppression. It's more about allowing us to survey our inner territory. It helps us to see beyond the boundaries of our self-image. But we put analysis and further action on hold. We don't try to fix things. We don't go spasming into an opinion about ourselves based upon that survey. And the simple beauty of this process is that when we suspend the reactions of what we should and shouldn't be feeling, there is a clarity and spaciousness. With that, we reconnect with our innate ethical sensitivity, the good karma which supports clarity and compassion. These, thankfully, are the basic qualities that we all have as human beings. But because our way of attending is often superficial or goal-oriented, those qualities aren't always accessible to us, so they surface dependent on a selfless regard, a regard that is without pressure, opinions, and judgments. This regard is fathoming attention. It just looks out for what is stressful and what is to be let go of. And this simple internal directness is often all we really need. We can generally figure out the details of what to do and how, or whether to do nothing at all, once we have got this point of view straight. A further development of attention is mindfulness, sati, the ability to bear a theme, mood, or thought or sensation in mind. It's a skillful use of mano, the mind organ, whereas fathoming is an active attention that sifts through the topics of the mind. Mindfulness holds attention on a point, such as a thought or sensation, in order to look into the nature of that as a phenomenon. For example, mindfulness attends to an emotion as an emotion and doesn't let it harden into an attitude or an action. It holds the boundary of the present moment so that we can really discern what a feeling is like and what a mood is, rather than act upon or explain or suppress them. Mindfulness is vital because in the feeling sense, there are no boundaries. Mental feelings go everywhere. And if that felt sense starts to proliferate, it becomes I am. I always will be. People don't like me. I am terrible. And goes on reverberating. Even in the case of a positive mood, if mindfulness is absent, we may assume that everything's great and be quite insensitive to the moods of others. So it's always skillful to study the domain of citta with mindfulness. Then we don't attach to the perception and feeling and proliferate around the heart impression or mind states that may subsequently arise. A complement to mindfulness is full awareness, sampajanya. Full awareness is the capacity to be alert and receptive, the ability to feel out what we're sensitive to. It's citta-based. Mindfulness holds a boundary so that we don't get overwhelmed, shut down, or react to the feelings that we have. Then with full awareness, we get the whole of it, how that impression arises and what it does. We may then understand this feeling or impression is based upon the perception and thought. Based upon this perception and thought, and it subsides when that thought or perception is removed. Quote, this negative impression arises with that perception or that memory, and it subsides when I practice loving kindness, or when I can just sit with it and let it subside. Together with mindfulness and full awareness, acknowledge what is going on and where it stops. They don't bring I am, I should be, into it. If we establish these skills of attention, they free the mind from acting on or reacting to the results of the past. If we attend to the present impressions, the present moods and sensations, and cut off the proliferations and projections, we're not living in the fog of resentment, fantasy, romance, or other biases. This means that our attention, and consequently our moods, actions, and speech, are going to be clearer and brighter. Because of this, we can get freer from our habitual action or inaction. Withdrawing from an action is still an action, and it gets to be a habit too. But if there is skillful attention to the heart, we can speak of how things seem, what incidents give rise to the feeling of being mistreated, and have a sense that, whether anyone else listens or responds, at least we have brought some clarity into our lives. We don't have to keep creating fresh kamma based upon old habits. Skillful attention is kamma that leads to the end of kamma. Maybe I'll leave it there.
I've always been impressed with how Ajahn Sucitto can articulate, you know, some very detailed maneuverings of the mind. You know, gets in there and goes to some, plumps to some deep levels of mind activity. Kind of have to take it in small bits and pieces. Really watch your own mind in relation to what he says. Sort of his own style of verbalizing kinds of Abhidhamma mind state kinds of things, but also a more heartfelt, comes from his own, it seems like it really comes from deep inside his own investigation.
Yeah, I kind of skipped over some sections here, but he does it in the sections that I read as well, but just, like you said, taking those really, like sort of providing really kind of rubber meets the road examples of how technical terms, you know, he sprinkles them through here, but he makes them so accessible.
I found it often very helpful.
And I don't have read that book before, or parts of it. I haven't usually heard the distinction between sati and sampajanya, that sati is more of a mind quality and sampajanya is more, you know, what we in the West call a heart quality. I think he says that in there, right?
Something like that.
I don't know if that was that clear distinction. Because he seemed to be kind of interchanging mind and heart some. It almost sounded like a talk from a diagram.
Well, these two terms he actually defines very clearly in these two sentences. A further development of attention is mindfulness, sati, the ability to bear a theme, mood, or thought or sensation in mind. And then a complement to mindfulness is full awareness, sampajanya. Full awareness is the capacity to be alert and receptive, the ability to feel out what we're sensitive to.
Points that always catch me. I've read that book, at least that section of the book, at least a couple of times, that sort of salient points that I find useful. It's just when he talks about one of the primary ways of kind of cutting out negative or habitual reaction patterns is by just starting right at the beginning with the kind of introducing or bringing up the perception of not self, that, you know, all of this is just conditioned stuff, you know, and that, you know, even if it's not a deep penetrating insight of not self, just holding that frame of this is just passing phenomena, conditioned, you know, and it's not who I am, makes it a whole lot easier just to kind of see it as a pattern that causes suffering, and makes it a lot easier to let go of, even if it's not a deep understanding of not self. It's like, oh, okay, I don't need to hold on to this because it's not who I am, you know. That's one thing that I found really helpful. And then the other kind of thing is just to see how the habitual perceptual patterns really conditions to what we actually seek out to experience. That, you know, the mood or the tendency of the mind, you know, actually find an object to support its existence. You know, so that if you're feeling irritated or you have a habitual tendency, say, towards irritation or anger or something like that, then, you know, in an interaction with somebody who's triggered that before, that's, you'll almost look for that kind of interaction or look for that particular quality to reinforce that mind that's habituated in that way, and kind of ignore everything else. Power of habituated patterns.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon, almost how we can see that our mind and our body is always constantly in flux and changing, but the way perception works is that we see everybody else as fixed and solid entities that don't change.
He's always doing that.
I was over thinking with one of the, I was having a conversation with one of the seals for us, and I was really taken by how peaceful she seemed, and I asked her how she does it, and how it's changed. She said she just doesn't tell stories anymore in her mind. You know, when she sees, you know, that mind starting to say, oh, well, he's this way, you know, he did this, this, and this. It's like, that's a lie. You know, I really don't know. Yeah, I saw this happen. I saw that happen. I saw it happen, but I do not know what he thought. I do not know what he thinks. I do not know what his intention was. So every time her mind starts telling a story, she just, she said she's almost gotten to the point she doesn't even arise anymore. It was really funny because as we were talking, I'm still in that mind, so she just kept interrupting. Nope, you're in a story. And I'm like, oh, you're in a story. I'm like, oh yeah, I gotta stop that. I'm gonna stop that. Nope, you're in a story. You can see how habitual it is.
Okay.